Hey, this is Chris.
And this is Eric.
And you're about to listen to an episode of Open Call Podcast.
Yeah, and we just want to let you know that we talk about Matthew Bourne's Cinderella and Ragtime.
At the Pasadena Playhouse in this episode.
We mentioned some elements of the plot that you might not know if you haven't seen, particularly Ragtime.
Yeah.
Cinderella, whatever. It's like not something you would know. Like the way they treat it is not a plot element.
Sure.
But there's elements of Ragtime that if you haven't seen it, you might want to wait until after you've seen Ragtime to listen to this episode if it's a show you're planning to see.
Spoilers ahead.
Yeah.
It's Open Call with Eric and Chris.
That's me.
It's a show that you'll never want to miss. It's Open Call.
It's Open Call. I'm Chris Grace.
And I'm Eric Michaud.
And this is our special episode to talk about
two shows
that we saw. We're not going to do news
no.
this time around because we're sort of recording this in the future.
Whoa, 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 whoa.
Ebenezer Scrooge.
That's my future noise.
Whoa, 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 whoa. So, I mean, we can make up news, but...
Christian Chenoweth will be playing the MC in Cap. Well, just make up anything.
By the way, did anything post since our last Band's Visit posted?
Band's Visit posted. Something else posted. Oh, Anastasia has also posted.
Did Head Over Heels close already?
It did.
Okay.
Yep. Look at us. We did news.
We did news.
There we go.
Everybody go see Band's Visit before it closes.
Yes. But it's going to tour. So hooray. And I doubt she'll do it, but I would love it if she would.
I want to ask you something, which is
anything you like.
Some of our friends in the theater world said, Band's Visit, I can't believe it's closing because it won 10 Tonys. It won 10 Tonys? I think it did.
He won, she won, it won score. I believe it won book, it won musical. Yeah, I mean, probably. I think he didn't supporting actor win as well.
Maybe. So, what's your perspective on like, it won 10 Tonys, it should be running longer than it.
No.
Than it is.
No. No, I really don't. I don't think so. Tonys are great, but like if that's not a guarantee of a run at all. I mean, Passion won Best Musical, Best Score, Best Actress, and it ran for like 3 months.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, it's not any indication of crowd appeal or mass appeal as far as winning awards. Do I think it deserved the awards it won? Absolutely. I loved the Band's Visit. But I don't think it's necessarily a mass appeal show. And I think it had a healthy run. I think it ran longer than I expected it to, for sure.
Uh-huh.
So I'm very pleased with it. Not to mention, you know, Yazbek has another show coming in. So he can let one close and let one open.
What's he got coming in?
Tootsie.
Oh, okay. Let me give you the 10 Tonys that the Band's Visit won.
Please do.
Best Musical.
Uh-huh.
Best Actor.
Mm-hmm.
Best Leading Actress.
Mm-hmm.
Best Supporting Actor.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember which one?
It was the husband.
No, it was the like you doll da, the guy who the tall suave guy who gave advice.
Oh, and the roller rink. Yes.
Best direction.
Mm-hmm.
Best original score.
Mm-hmm.
Book. Best worded book. It did best book.
Mm-hmm.
Best lighting design.
The lighting was lovely.
It was very lovely. Best sound design.
Yeah.
And best orchestrations.
There you go.
We saw the two best lighting designs of the season.
Harry Potter.
Harry Potter and Band's Visit.
Yeah, Harry Potter's lighting design is insanely good.
Yeah. So, yeah, I just think it's, do we know if it recouped?
I believe it did, actually.
I would hope it did, because I would hope you would be able to keep the costs down
mm-hmm.
a little bit for that show.
I believe it did. I believe it recouped.
And probably for a... I wonder if alcohol sales get... Like, venue revenues are part of that or not. Probably not.
I don't believe so.
Because it's a one act, so it wasn't helped by, like, you know...
Sure.
So, yeah,
presumably... I believe the theater keeps that completely.
Yeah. Nothing else posted that we know about?
I don't believe so.
Okay.
But lots of new stuff coming in.
Yeah. What are we hearing about Tootsie?
I've heard that it's very funny. I've heard that the score is good. It is set in present time. It is not set in the early 80s like the film is.
That is very interesting.
Yeah. I've heard that works
okay.
somehow.
Who's playing?
Santino Fontana, who I love. I think he's so charming and so lovely. The only thing, the one thing I will say, because I posted this actually on Facebook yesterday, the poster for it is him in the Tootsie Drag, but like with his face covered in shaving cream and he's shaving. Uh-huh. And the, I don't know if it's the picture or just the way, and the font of the title.
Fontina?
Oh my God. I married this person. The font of the logo, it looks like it's like Tootsie coming to NBC this fall. It does not look like a musical. It really doesn't look like a musical. It looks like it's a promo for a TV show. But yeah, it's I'm looking forward to that. And then Beetlejuice starts in 11 weeks. Carrie Butler posted that on Twitter today. 11 weeks we start. I think that show's going through some big retooling right now.
So I'll be very curious to see how Tootsie comes off in 2019.
Mm-hmm.
Because I assume that they will have updated the book to deal with the fact that he's basically like,
I'm taking a job from a lady.
I mean, what's the difference between this and Joanna Mann, the movie? You know? Yeah, so, I mean, it's got a good creative team.
Well, then there's your next, there's the musical that you need to write.
Joanna Mann, the musical.
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. And White Girls, the musical.
Sure.
Soul Man, the musical.
Oh, God.
So David Yazbek's music and lyrics, love him.
Uh-huh.
And
what else has he written that you loved?
Besides Band's Visit. Just Band's Visit.
Oh, okay.
Because actually, he did Full Monty.
He did the Full Monty. He did Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, and he did Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown, which I enjoyed.
I don't really love Full Monty that much. And if I have concerns about Tootsie being problematic, then maybe him being involved with Women on the Verge isn't the best.
Maybe not.
You considering know, it was backstory.
Because like it was like there were no Latin people in that show.
Yeah, that bothers me. That takes
actually it would be
Spain.
Latin.
It'd be Hispanic.
Yeah, Hispanic. It would be know. Latin.
But still, like
yeah. Well, Sherry Renee Scott is very Hispanic.
I believe that
Laura
there
Benanti,
is
Pat of the Pone, very Hispanic.
I believe that there is a. I'm not super clear on the racial. I guess semantics of that because there are Hispanic white people because when you do this always confused me, but on the census, it'll be like white people,
not Hispanic,
white, non-Hispanic percentage. Yeah. And it's like, why is that
a thing
versus like, you know, white I'm people, white, non-Asian people or whatever,
right?
Like, you know?
Yeah.
I think because there's some, overlap between like, Spain, people from Spain are sort of also considered European. So maybe there's some crossover between like Spanish people
or
and
like
Caucasian.
And like Argentina, I think too. Cause like a lot
yes,
of
for sure.
Argentinians are very light skinned.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the second theme of our podcast is like genetic studies. So it's good.
And race relations.
Yeah. Race. I mean, anything I talk about ends up being about race relations.
It sure does.
Well, that's me living in America, isn't it?
At the beginning of the millennium.
No.
Oh, you make fun of me, but I had to deal with your joke there.
Yeah, but mine was, you know,
awful.
Great for typographers.
Yes.
Just trying to think of like a sans serif font. Santino font.
Oh my God.
So the two shows that we saw that we're going to talk about tonight.
Yes.
Let's talk about the first one first.
Okay.
What was that one?
Matthew Bourne's Cinderella.
Which we saw at the Amundsen Theater here in Los Angeles.
Part of our subscription to their season.
Yeah.
Yes, this is a ballet. Matthew Bourne, who did Swan Lake several years ago, back in the early 2000s, late 90s, the all-male Swan Lake that was very, very well received. He also has done ballets of like Edward Scissorhands that played at BAM a few years ago.
Last year we saw The Red Shoes.
Yes, we did.
Which I really enjoyed, which you were just okay with.
I was okay with. The thing...
You're
the
sort of just okay with him in general.
I am kind of okay with him in general. He also choreographed the musical Mary Poppins. I find that a lot of his choreography, especially in his ballets, not so much in Mary Poppins, but in his ballets, tends to lend itself more to pantomime than ballet. And Cinderella was no different. In the first 15 minutes of Cinderella, there was very, very little dancing at all. It was very pantomime-y. We're setting up characters and whatnot. And I feel like that can be done better in dance because it's been done through dance for years. I mean, that's what ballet is, telling the story through dance. I don't necessarily fault him. It's his style. It's maybe not a style that I totally love. I also find a lot of his choreography very repetitive.
Mm-hmm.
Did we ever find out what that character was called? The fairy godfather?
The angel.
The angel. Okay, the angel. there, I mean, I understand a motif and carrying through certain movements, but there was one kind of series of a little variation that he did that he just kept doing over and over again.
What was that variation?
He kept doing this little like knee bent thing where he would roll his head back and it was, and then a lot of back attitudes.
That's right.
Love the back attitudes. I'm sorry, not back attitude, back arabesque. So it was just like, after a while, it was like, okay, I have seen this dude do this like 35 times now. Let's move it along. Let's give him something else to do.
Yeah.
So just to kind of go over the differences, this is not the Rodgers and Hammerstein, obviously, Cinderella. This is the
Which was news to some of my friends that I saw there.
Yeah.
Friends of mine from the improv world that came up to us at intermission. They were like, oh, we didn't realize, we thought this was a musical. And they were like, why isn't anybody talking?
Right. Why ain't nobody singing? So it's the classical Cinderella ballet music. This production has been set in the 1940s. I think it is in 1940 or 1941.
Yeah.
So World War II is in full swing. It's set in London. Cinderella is still, you know, kind of a sweet young girl who's at the mercy of her stepmother and stepsisters. Her father is still alive in this one, but is wheelchair bound and seems to be.
Is he not alive in some other ones?
Yeah, normally he's in most versions of Cinderella. The stepmother is now the surviving parent, which is
who's the one in Into the Woods? There's the guy that comes in and he's like,
Cinderella's father is alive and present in Into the Woods, but also kind of like either drunk or just completely disinterested and doesn't notice what's happening. But in the Disney version, there is no father. He's dead. Both of Cinderella's parents are dead.
Is it Sleeping Beauty that has a dad?
Yeah.
The one that's like,
if you could see the visuals, I'm sure you'd enjoy them, but you can't. So
you know who I'm talking about? He does the, like, he has these big eyebrows. He's like,
the father in Sleeping Beauty is a very slender, dark haired, goateed man, I believe.
White goatee?
Dark.
Who am I thinking of then?
Are you thinking of the prince's father in Cinderella?
Maybe.
Kind of big bellied, kind of cute. Blustery. Yes, you're thinking of.
Okay.
Yeah. You're thinking of the king in Cinderella.
Okay.
So back to the ballet. It's set in the 1940s. It's during World War II. Cinderella's at the mercy of her family. Dad's alive, but kind of not fully there. It seems like something's happened to Dad.
How many of the other ones have like lots of brothers and stuff?
Yeah, I don't know what the relationship to any of those other people were. I think they were
all brothers.
Then why was one of them kept trying to fuck her?
Because he was weird.
He was gross. He was
a pervert.
There was one guy just randomly in their house.
Smelling feet.
Who was smelling her feet constantly and like trying to get her to sleep with him or like cozy up to him.
Yeah.
We were very close. We were like in the third or fourth row. So he was really milking those facial expressions.
Yeah.
Like there was a whole lot going on. But there were all these other people. Like there was a kid with a plane who just kept running around. There were
at least three brothers.
Yeah, I guess they were brothers, but
there was the gay one, there was the little one, there was this foot smelling one.
Yeah.
So
Cinderella, the plot, the biggest problem I had with the piece was the storytelling is really unclear. Mm. So it's World War II. There is no prince. Cinderella is.
Yeah, there is.
He's not a prince. He's an aviator.
But he's the equivalent.
Yeah, but he's not
the prince.
But he's not royalty of any sort.
He's military. Like, he's treated like military royalty.
But is he? Because that's the biggest problem I had. Like, there's a scene in the underground after the ball or after the dance thing where he's mugged. He's attacked by a hooker. He's then mugged again, and he's robbed. And I'm sorry, but, like, if this man has any kind of stature, he's an injured war veteran in military uniform
in
London after an attack has just happened. How many times is that going to happen?
I think that's a statement about like treatment of veterans or something, but at the ball, he's definitely treated as royalty.
Sure. The ball was also very confusing because at the beginning of it, they all appear to be dead. And then the angel raises them all from the dead. And then, but also he shows up at her house before the ball.
Yeah.
She like steals him away and hides him, I guess, in her bedroom. And then, it was very unclear to me.
The stepmother had like really,
seven numbers and was too much.
None of this really bothered me because it's not meant to be like
a narrative.
It's not meant to be like a coherent, like, you know, It's clearly got, I mean, it has an angel dancing around the entire time.
Sure, but the angel needs to learn about through line.
I'll just remind everybody this is coming from someone who likes that a child can play pinball without any sensory perception.
He can feel the ball moving. He has the sense of touch.
Uh-huh.
He can't see and he can't hear and he can't talk, but that doesn't mean he can't be a pinball wizard. And I never said, hold on, going back, I've never said that I was a fan of the plot of Tommy. I'm a fan of the music and the staging was fantastic.
I know, but I'm saying that the plot isn't
dumb.
But like the plot of Tommy, and I will argue of the other show that we saw last night, there's holes in the plots of almost everything we see. So
sure.
I don't think the plot holes are like, I just think it's weird to cite the plot holes for one thing and then be accepting of gigantic plot holes in another one.
Sure.
Like a lady buries a baby in the ground and then you're like, cool, you want to live with this baby again? Get here, have it back. That's just as big a plot hole as anything we saw in Matthew Bourne's Cinderella.
Well, it's not a plot hole. It's just a questionable plot move. It's not a hole. It's just like, what are you doing?
Well, similar to Star Wars Last Jedi, this was a discussion that happened a lot. They are plot holes if the other characters act like it's normal or like if the other characters don't call it out. Like when the dad, not to jump too far ahead, but a lady bears a baby in the ground and then they pull the baby out and they're like, here, you can have it back. And then the father of the household comes back and is not like, this lady needs to go to the mental institution and this child needs to go to protective services. I don't care what you say. This lady tried to murder a baby.
Well, he doesn't know that. I don't think they ever tell him that. I think that they just think she took them in.
But the police know. Like,
sure, but...
Yeah, it's just... that's... You know what I mean? Like, yeah. For the mother and the other brother and everybody be just like, okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
For even the other friends of the woman who put the baby in the ground to be like, oh, well, at least she has a place to stay. You're like, no one is like... that's not safe for that crazy woman to have that baby again.
Yeah.
So that's what makes it a plot hole is when the other people are like, don't have what your reactions to that would be.
Sure.
So anyway, that's,
but I guess what I'm saying is like plot holes are one thing, but if you're opening an act where everyone is dead and then rises and they never explain why they're dead or how they're dead. And then they raise from the dead and they don't ever address the fact that they were dead is very confusing to an audience.
I think it's as confusing as you let it be because it's not. I think it just depends. Like if it was in the middle of Raisin in the Sun and you're trying to do like a slice of life play and you've got this really weird plot element in the middle of it, but in a very impressionistic dance, I mean, in a piece where people are dancing ballet the entire time as an expression of what's happening, then I feel like there's more room for. It's a poetic license that I don't mind giving the creator. Because I don't think that form really benefits from being like rigorously like, well, this happened. Because if you wanted to be that rigorous about it, then you should write a play where people get to talk and explore all the nuances of like, he took them back in time. Like then if it's, it needs the tools of like being able to sort of like prosecute the story with science fiction. To be like, you know, we're really going to dig in deep into these details of like how this works. I bet there's a lot of things like, I haven't seen Peggy Sue Got Married in a long time, but like where you have sort of like magical realism elements to it where you just kind of like, yeah, you just roll with it or don't, you know? That's why I don't think it's that important to this because basically the only important storyline is this angel comes down and gives this girl a connection to somebody else. And then it succeeds and then he moves on. Like that's basically the plot of that show.
Yeah.
I did think it was too long.
Oh yeah. It's 3 40-minute acts and it could have very easily been 2 40-minute acts.
I appreciate a 40-minute act though. I really like that.
Yeah. But like it very easily could have lost one of the acts, condensed some of the action and it would have been just fine. I would have enjoyed it far more.
I think one thing that does make it feel long is because of the narrative elements and probably because of the pantomime that you don't like. You start to see the dance as, oh, like they're dancing now and it means this. So their dance, like there was a part where they put on a record mm-hmm. and they danced like popular dance of the time. Mm-hmm. And it's like, this is like a metaphor for them dancing popular dance.
Right.
But then there's elements that are kind of like, I don't really know what this is.
What's
like,
yeah.
They're sort of dancing still and they're sort of expressing character. But now I don't really know what's happening. Like some of the air raid dances and stuff, mm-hmm. Or where I was just like, I kind of get what's happening, but I feel like if I've been encouraged to see everything as having an analog
to reality,
some reality or storytelling element, then there's time. I think that's what makes it feel long.
Yeah.
To me, the most successful parts of it were like, very almost simple analogies of just like, I have a dressmaking dummy mm-hmm. that I've put a military costume on and mm-hmm. I'm going to sort of fantasize about dancing with the soldier.
Right.
And that was, I thought, really well executed, mm-hmm. simple
and effective.
Yeah.
And clear.
Yeah.
Yeah. There were clarity moments that I was just like, I don't get what we're doing. I don't get what you're trying to say with this. And therefore I'm kind of checking out a little bit.
There were probably also times where to your point about the stepmother having a lot, there's a little bit of like, she's drunk and obnoxious and she's hitting on the soldier. Got it. Mm-hmm. And then it'd be like, she's still doing it.
She's still doing it. Now it's a second soldier, but she's doing much of the same.
Yeah.
Oh wait, there's a third soldier and yeah. it's still happening.
That said, the third act of the show, and particularly the last scene of the show, I thought was really beautiful. Mm-hmm. And basically, I was like, I liked it because the ending of it was so effective to me.
Yep.
And sweet and warm.
Give them a strong ending. They'll forgive you anything.
Yeah. And I mean, that is true. Like a year from now, I'm just going to remember what happened in that last scene.
Yeah.
And even though I thought the angel guy was kind of corny at times, I'm going to remember him because he was like very striking and seemed to me like a very good dancer. Often when we watch these things, I kind of like think he seems like a good dancer. I wonder what Eric thinks because I know that as a lay person that I can probably be fooled into thinking some people are good dancers when they're not.
Oh, sure.
So.
Oh, sure.
Did you think they were good dancers in general?
In general, I thought the stepmother was quite good. Uh-huh. The Cinderella was very good. The prince was fine. I thought there were some people in the ensemble that I was like, you're not great.
Yeah.
It kind of felt like, because it did seem like a very mature cast. Like mm-hmm. a lot of the dancers were very clearly a little bit older than what would normally be in a ballet company.
Yeah.
Right. So I think this is a good opportunity for like dancers who were like, oh, I was with Pacific Northwest, but then, you know, I'm 40. So I don't really want to do, or I kind of can't do a Swan Lake anymore, but I can do this.
What's old for a ballerina?
28.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really like, I mean, that's not true, but like if you've established yourself, like you can probably dance until your 30s now, but
well, my college
just can't handle it.
My college was a very small art school in North Carolina, and we had a ballet dance program there. And our college also had a high school of performing arts on the same campus. And the ballet school, it was pretty much for the dance program because uh-huh. there really wasn't like, there was one, like you could be a senior in high school and be in the drama program, mm-hmm. but there wasn't like a freshman, you know, whatever.
Sure.
But there were like freshman through senior high school ballet girls. Mm-hmm. And that would feed right into the college program. And I remember people saying like, if they're still there in their second year of college, they're done.
Yeah.
Like they're not good enough to be in it because
if you haven't made it by then, if you haven't been plucked by a
right.
company.
So they would go to high school and then after they graduate high school, they would go to like ABT or whatever.
Sure.
And so I remember just thinking like there were these juniors in college who in the real world are like 21 and they're basically like, yeah, I committed my whole life to this thing and I'm not going to make it.
And it's a horrible thing, but like, cause I mean, it's not like that in acting. It's not like that in musical theater because you're like, well, you know, I'm going to age into the roles that I'm right for or whatnot. But with ballet, it's very much like, oh, you're 23 and you haven't danced professionally with a company yet. Sorry. You're not going to.
Yeah. You could now you could age into Matthew Bourne's New Adventures.
There you go. That's the name of the company, New Adventures.
One thing I really liked about it is I think he is very good at creating a lot of nuanced detail based on character.
Mm-hmm.
I think no matter where you look on stage, there's something going on with the character.
Yes.
They're very specific. They have a very high integrity as to they are always doing something in character, even in a dance where everybody's doing the same move. And then even when they're not dancing, they've all got little like tracks, mm-hmm. little stories going on.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of reminded me of like putting Sleep No More on a proscenium stage.
Yeah.
They all had their own inner lives and they're really different from each other.
Yes. And I think that might possibly be part of something that bothers me a little bit.
Yeah, I can see that.
When you're looking at ballet, or at least when I'm used to, because I grew up in the ballet world. So looking at a ballet, core to ballet, like the ensemble basically of a ballet.
You want them to be the same.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't want to notice that one swan who's doing it differently. That drives right. me nuts. Or I don't, that, you know, that one flower in Nutcracker who's a little bit off, that it pulls your eye and it's not supposed to.
Right.
But in this, they're all doing it. So it's
looks
messy.
So like when they did, they put on the record and they would dance popular dances, they each kept their character stories going.
Right.
So like the creepy guy kept doing creepy things. When he would do the pose, I mean, I thought it was really interesting. When he would do the dance moves, he would do them like kind of sneering and like gross. And if he got near anybody's like foot, he would like
kind of give it a whiff.
In the middle of choreography sometimes.
Yeah.
So, but if you squint your eyes and want to see them as a big company,
it looks messy.
The lines are all different.
Yeah.
And I would even say like they were changing the rhythms to match whatever they felt like.
A little bit. I will say, going back to your level of detail comment, the design of the show is beautiful.
Yeah.
The set is quite extravagant.
Yeah.
A lot of moving parts. You know, there are air raids and bombs dropped during the show.
It's very loud.
Very loud. Lots of flashing lights, but also like set pieces crumbling and things falling. And
one of us was jumping out all over the place out of shock.
And one of them wasn't me.
Oh, well, you sold me out real quick.
Sure did. Welcome to married life with me.
I thought that I did think that set design was great. I thought the
costumings were lovely.
Costumings
were lovely.
Yeah, yes.
That's a word.
Sound design was good.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you know, it's weird. It's like there's nothing about the craft of that show that I can fault. Like,
no.
I was going to say if it comes to your town, but it's not. It's ending here.
Just
and
here.
It. So if you live in Los Angeles, come see it. But if you get a chance to see something by Matthew Bourne, I think it's definitely worth seeing it as an artist to just see like what somebody who has an exquisite craft, and he has clearly a very specific vision on what he wants to do. Now, you might just not agree with how he wants to tell stories.
Sure.
But that feels like what you're like, it just, his way of telling stories
just doesn't line up with me.
Yeah.
And that's fine. I definitely see the artistry in it. I definitely see what he brings to it. And it's kind of like what we were talking about in the last episode about when we were talking about Dolly, about how a new actor can take a role and reinterpret it in a way that you hadn't thought of before. And I think that's kind of what he does with ballet, because his Swan Lake was a very wild reinterpretation of the story.
Yeah.
This is a very wild reinterpretation of the Cinderella story. I believe he also has a Nutcracker out there that is very weird. His Edward Scissorhands was very strange. I recall there's a scene, I remember very vividly, there was a scene in Edward Scissorhands where he was, if you are familiar with the film, where he's doing all the topiaries, where he's cutting all the,
uh-huh.
There's an entire scene where he's cutting all these topiaries, and then the topiaries all came to life. And there was this whole big dance number with just the living topiaries. Mm-hmm. Very weird looking, very strange. All these people with like triangle block different shapes on their heads as far as shrubbery. But yeah, he's definitely got a vision, and he's definitely got a very interesting point of view. So it's worth seeing just to kind of look at where the art form can go and where it's going and what he wants to bring with it.
It was already on tour a little bit.
Oh.
It was in Charlotte and Washington, D.C., and this is like the end of its little U.S. leg.
This is the end of the new adventure.
Right, and it will have some more, I believe, international dates at some point.
Oh.
However... it is available on DVD and Blu-ray.
Is it?
And I'm kind of, I kind of want to see it on Blu-ray. Like, I wouldn't mind getting it to just see some parts of it again.
To see, yeah, I wouldn't either, just to kind of maybe watch it through again and go, okay, like, yeah, now I get what he was going for. It might just need a second viewing for me.
Also, it's got the making of Cinderella.
Well, I bet that had some interviews explaining what the heck's going on in some places.
And they'll be like, we know this is going to confuse some people. And if you're interested in Matthew Bourne in general, on January 31st, 2019, they will be in movie theaters.
January 31st when? So if you'd like to travel back in time. If you'd like to travel back in time.
Oh, also May 21st, 2019.
There you go. Which, there you go. What is going to be? Is it Cinderella?
Swan Lake.
Oh, Swan Lake. Which I think is also available on DVD, isn't it?
Maybe so. I wonder if this is a... I wonder if they just broadcast an old version or if they really do it again.
Pretty sure they probably broadcast.
Oh, no. Have created a stunning reimagining of this classic production.
Oh.
So it's a reimagining of Swan Lake.
It's a reimagining of his first reimagining, or this is the reimagining of...
A reimagining of this classic New Adventures production.
Oh.
So they are
remounting.
Yeah, also the Cinderella that we just saw
was a remount
of the original, which debuted in the United States in 1999 at the Amundsen Theater.
Wow.
So he just loves Los Angeles.
Yeah. You know, I will say when I moved out here, I was so worried about like not having enough theater and not having enough access to culture and theater, and I was like, oh, it's all film and television. And I'm really so pleasantly surprised by the quality and the level and the amount of stuff out here that's happening.
Yeah. Meanwhile, we're missing Inspector Calls.
Right.
We won't be able to see that.
Right.
That's the
Jerry Gutierrez production from Broadway in the late 90s, I believe.
Yeah. We're missing a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But like, I mean, in the Amundsen, if you've never been there, throughout the lobby, they have, you know, photos of shows that started there and whatnot. And there, I mean, the Heiress with Cherry Jones started there. Drowsy Chaperone started there. There are several very big shows that went on to Broadway and went on to win several Tonys that started at that theater. Mm-hmm. So it's very exciting to see stuff, especially new stuff like Soft Power.
Yeah.
There, you know, maybe Soft Power may not have a big life ahead of it, but there are things that we're gonna see there that are going to go on and
mm-hmm.
maybe not Amelie either.
Another place that we saw things that went on to have future lives,
mm-hmm.
the Pasadena Playhouse.
Which we saw last evening. We saw their second preview of their new production of Ragtime,
uh-huh.
a show that Chris had never seen before.
Uh-huh.
It is my number 5 top 5 musical.
Uh-huh.
So I was very excited to see it again, as I've only ever seen the first Broadway national tour. So that didn't sound right. The national tour of the first Broadway production,
mm-hmm.
which was after Livent went under, after Garth Drabinsky fled the country. So it was a very stripped down version of the show, much smaller cast, much smaller orchestra, very minimal set. So I never got a chance to see the opulence of that original Broadway production or the 2009 revival that looked like it was set in a jukebox. So, I didn't like that set design. So this production is a wholly new production, mounted specifically at Pasadena Playhouse. They've built it in house is what I'm basically trying to say.
Yeah.
I'm very tired. So it's an interesting take on it. The entire set is like wooden crates and boxes and pallets.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of, I made a joke when we first walked in. It kind of looks like Ragtime being set in the final scene of the first Indiana Jones film. Mm-hmm. It looks like one of those boxes has the Ark of the Covenant in it somewhere. But that being said, the production I think is pretty strong. Their sound mix, I mean, again, it was a second preview, so their sound mix wasn't great. We were having a hard time hearing, we were in the balcony, so like, for a show like Ragtime, it needs to be loud.
Uh-huh.
You need to feel that music vibrating through you, and we didn't. So that was kind of a little bit disappointing that the music was just very, very quiet throughout. The orchestra, I believe, is up behind the stage, so you don't ever...
Yeah, they pointed at the end, I don't know where they are.
So the orchestra is quite quiet as well. And for a score like Ragtime, you need volume. You need just power behind it. I thought the cast overall was very good.
Yeah.
Nicole House has a beautiful voice. The mother had a very good voice.
Tata had a very nice voice.
He did. He had a couple pitch problems in places that kind of bothered me. But no, it really did. Actually, we took two of our castmates from the production of Thrones that we're currently working on with us, and Allie and I both commented like, "Oh, he's got some. He had a couple ones that were like."
Father had a nice voice.
He had a nice voice. I thought he read too young.
Yeah.
For the role, but.
Sarah had a nice voice.
Sarah had a very nice voice. Yeah, I mean overall,
and, is he called younger brother?
Yeah, mother's younger brother.
The name of his character is mother's younger brother.
Yep.
Evelyn Nesbitt has a nice voice.
Yeah, I mean, pretty much all the leads did.
Yeah.
So it's a reduced cast. It's a pretty good sized cast for a original production.
The funny thing is, it's still a big cast.
Yeah, but like,
but people are playing multiple parts.
People are playing multiple parts, and especially. The African American portion of the cast is very small.
I would have liked that to have been bigger.
Yeah, Getting Ready Rag is Cole House and two people.
Yeah.
That's it. And it just didn't have the level of energy. Overall, I think the level of energy in the show was pretty low.
Well, you were saying they probably were rehearsing all day.
Yeah, I think they were probably exhausted.
Working on things, and they had a,
sure.
You know.
But you can't realize, let the audience see that.
Well, I didn't realize it was a preview when I saw it. I think that it was... it's a really good production. I think I like the show itself, the material.
Mm-hmm.
I think I like the show. I don't think I love it. I'd like maybe need to see it again, maybe.
I think I love the score. But yeah. Now, after having seen the show itself again,
yeah,
there were book scenes that I did not recall
yeah.
from the original production that I saw. So... And Allie actually said the same thing. She's like, there are book scenes I don't remember.
Right.
So I'm wondering if this is the newly revised version of Ragtime, that like maybe they revised it for the revival in 2009.
Yeah.
And then, and therefore that's the now the published script that you can get. I don't know. I would maybe do some research on that. But the book in general, there are some scenes that I was like, I don't love what's happening. I don't love the way this is written. So I think... It may have sadly fallen off of my top five.
Oh,
seeing the show, I really love.
That's not a good.
No, I know the score. No. I'm not. I don't want to say that like this is a bad production and you shouldn't go see it. It absolutely is not. It's a very good production, and the voices are great. And it's a very like the design is interesting. The costumes are great. It's definitely worth seeing. It's just I think the scene, because I've only seen the show once, I think seeing it again, I was kind of like, ooh, the book scenes aren't as good as I remember them being in the score. Mm-hmm. The score is so incredible.
Yeah.
That I feel like the book kind of was a little bit of a letdown.
Book by?
Terrence McNally.
That's right.
Yeah. So who once asked me for a napkin? we were outside the opening night of the Full Monty on Broadway, and he turned to me and asked if I had a napkin, and I said no, and he goes, I have mustard on my hand, and I said, you're Terrence McNally, and then he walked away from me.
Yeah,
like, I was a little bit starstruck.
Yeah, you're like, good convo.
Yeah, but he had mustard on his hand. There you go.
I like the show. This podcast is just going to be called Sound Mix Central. because it was just, I hope they bump up the sound mix because we were in the mezzanine. So, you know, we were a little further away, but it just didn't hit us. It was like when we saw Color Purple. It felt like the sound mix ended like 10 rows ahead of us or
yeah.
something. Except a couple gunshots and stuff that like were right in our ear.
Yeah.
They had like a surround sound speaker set up, and sure. One of the speakers was like right behind us.
Yeah, the gunshots for Cole House and the spoiler, and the man on the megaphone like come out with your hands up. It was right behind us. It was very loud.
So
and scary.
Maybe we should beep out that spoiler. Like if you want to see Ragtime, that's like
the show's 20 years old at this point.
Yeah, but
if you're listening to a theater podcast,
I didn't know.
Okay,
like.
I didn't say what happens. I just said there were gunshots. Okay, we'll bleep it.
Yeah.
And we're back.
So I thought that I think I told you this, but like the rhythms of the book, not the book, but like I would consider the structure of the plot of a show part of the book, even though
sure.
there are some scenes that don't have a book. Like there's like, you know what I mean? Like, even if it's three songs in a row, it's still kind of the book.
It's part of the narrative.
If you talk about how they are moving the story along.
Sure.
So, the rhythm of, we see a little bit of action, and then someone sings a pretty long, dramatic song that feels like it should end an act. That kind of happens like four times in a row.
Yeah, there is definitely an epicness to the score.
Yeah,
where which every song feels like this giant showstopper.
And I wonder if that makes the songs themselves be like, oh my God, this one song is great. And when you think about an individual song from the show, you're like, that song is beautiful.
Yep.
But seeing them stacked up in a row, with, and I was not familiar with the plot, felt a little like, God, we're making every single moment like important.
It gets a little exhausting after a while. Yeah, that's another part of why I was like, maybe it's kind of fallen off my top five, because it's just like, God, there's a...
Well, I think you then might remember like, oh, but I love this song and I love this song. You know?
Yeah.
And that I mentioned to you, it feels like Les Mis. Because Les Mis is similarly exhausting.
Mm-hmm.
Especially, there's a lot of hits in Act 2 of Les Mis, but Act 2 of Les Mis basically feels like an American Idol, episode of American Idol, where it's like, you get to sing your song, and now this person sings their song.
Sure.
There's a lot of solos of, you know, I don't know. This reminded me of Assassins. It reminded me of Parade. There's something about the Americana feel behind it that reminded me of
that kind
shows.
Of patriotic kind of Americana.
It's an interesting show to me. It does, you know, a compliment to this show is it makes me want to explore the source material a little more.
Yeah, like,
I
want to
read the book. I kind of want to see the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I mentioned to you that I'm still sorting out how I feel in general about the, like, there is something in the heart of a, again, this is about race, of a white liberal artistic creator. And this is something that has been true, like, for decades, where their intention is good and they want to highlight the problems of race in America. But there's something about the way they use black characters to be sort of the like the moving parts in a tragic story that starts to feel a little, I don't know, not exploitative, like whatever the like most like innocent version of exploitation is. Because I was saying yesterday, like it feels like when, if you have a gay character in the play, they have to get AIDS and die.
Mm.
Because like that's the way you want to talk about society, and like that's the way that they express themselves in like a melodramatic way, or you know, in a way that serves drama.
You want to highlight this problem, but by highlighting that problem, you're giving that one gay character the like you're kind of putting them in a box.
And it starts to feel almost like, God, only bad stuff happens to the black people in your things. You know, like and so the, especially when I found out that it wasn't based on anything, like, you know, I thought that it's kind of a melodrama. Mm. So I don't know. I'm still sorting out my feelings. I don't really know, but it just, something about it didn't like resonate completely with me. I sort of got taken out of it by those elements. And I will say one of the things that took me out of it was the baseball song.
Yeah.
Which we talked about yesterday. But basically, like, there's a really fun, energetic song about baseball.
What a game.
But it happens concurrently with a really sharp, dramatic turn with Cole House.
Mm-hmm.
So while he's basically, like, at the either depths of his...
losing his mind.
Plot, yeah. He's really going off the rails, and he's doing the most dangerous things in his storyline. The white characters go see a baseball game and they sing a sort of satirical song about like the presence of immigrants in baseball.
Mm-hmm.
But it struck me as a little like, even when the white people are having like a really, they're having a dramatic moment too.
Mm-hmm.
They still get to go just watch a baseball game and sing a fun song.
Yeah.
And the show itself doesn't seem aware of that tension.
Mm-hmm.
Because nothing in that song pointed to any thoughts of that guy or the son thinking about what was happening to Cole House at that same time. Meanwhile, he's like hiding out, being like stalked by the police.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, the baseball game is supposed to be not only a diversion for the audience, I think, because like there's so much dramatic stuff happening. I think they want to give the audience a moment to laugh and have a fun moment.
Yeah.
But I also think it's supposed to be a distraction for the father and the son to get away from everything that's happening. They're, you know, they try to run away to Atlantic City. It doesn't work. They're trying to escape. And I think part of what the mother's issue is with the father is that he won't deal with the reality of what their world is. Earlier in the show, she says something about, after finding the baby, you would have gently closed the door and gently turned the key and gently told me not to look for fear what I would see. And I think that's her problem with him, is that she's starting to see the world for what it is and he refuses to. And
the baseball game is a version of that.
I think that's what it is. Which, in, if you look at it that way, I think it makes a little bit more sense as far as why it's there. But it also does take away from the fact that like Kohlhaas is going through some serious shit right now, and maybe we don't need to focus on this part.
Well, the only reckoning that she gives from that perspective is when he tells, first of all, she kind of is like, you never talked to the kid, spend some time with him. And he's like, well, let's go to a baseball game. I, in that moment, I was a little bit like, hey, at least he's doing something with the kid.
Yeah.
But she calls him a fool when he does that, instead of, I guess, sort of sitting down and talking to him about what happened to Kohlhaas.
Right. Because the kid is very clearly confused and very clearly like looking for answers as to why is this happening and why do you feel this way about Kohlhaas? Because the father is very clearly against him.
Yeah.
Whereas the mother isn't. So it's, the mother understands why he's, I mean, she maybe doesn't agree with his motives or his tactics, but she agrees with his motives and why he's doing it.
I also kind of thought like, well, I don't know what you're going to tell this kid. Like it, when he was like, let's go to a baseball game, I was like, that's kind of not unreasonable. Like, just take the kid and
let's just go have fun.
What are you going to do? Sit down with the kid and be like, listen, first of all, I'm a huge racist.
Right.
You know? So I almost feel like maybe if we heard from the mother during the baseball game, like back at the house and seeing her spirit, if that thing of like avoiding reality was part of the construction of that song, then
it didn't work for you.
It's presence as a diversion makes sense in the plot of Ragtime, but its presence as a diversion as an element to sort of divert the people watching Ragtime, because the story's kind of heavy and we need some fun, that doesn't sit right with me.
Sure.
Because it's like, then don't introduce a social justice storyline that's really uncomfortable.
Right. If you don't want to deal with the realities of what this storyline is, then avoid it.
Yeah, because since it's not based on a true story, you decided to make this tragic black character and you decided to make his life really hard and rough, and then you decided that it was too heavy and you wanted to distract us from it.
Right. Well, so, I mean, they are following the plot of the novel, so they didn't necessarily make the decision to make that character's life so hard.
But they decided to put that baseball song in.
Sure, but I think that's a musical theater thing. I think that's a there are plenty of like very serious musicals that have a comic number thrown in just to cut the tension, and I think that's a musical theater trope more than
obviously that's a trope, but then I think Kohlhaas should get that comedy number. Like, in the middle of his, like, give him the agency of, like, I'm my life isn't so, like, maybe that makes his perspective more just, like, I'm doing what I want to do, but also, because later he is a little bit, like, I'm making my own decisions, you know, when he decides to do what he does later. It's a little bit, like, I don't know. Like, it's weird when you, or put it this way, in the curtain calls, Kohlhaas is the last one about.
Uh-huh.
So he's the lead of the show, presumably.
Mm-hmm.
There's times in that show where it doesn't feel like that.
Yeah.
And I know it's a big ensemble piece, but his story is the most like,
it's the driving factor through all.
Right. So if in your instincts you're going like, his story's getting to be a little much, let's move away from it.
Then it's no longer his story.
Yeah, something about that didn't sit right with me. I'm only thinking through this now. But I remember at the end, I was almost a little surprised. Oh, he's bowing last. Oh, I was like, oh, I guess it's his story.
Yeah,
you know? It's
like the leads of the show really are mother and him.
Right.
And then I would say the next lead like would Tata? Be with Tate. Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. I mean, that is what happens when you're a big ensemble piece.
Yeah. You just can't focus too much time on each storyline.
I admire the scope of the show. Like, I think it's cool to have a show that's like trying to intertwine all these different storylines. I think that's very interesting.
I love the punctuation of how each group has kind of their actual real life person that they there's like the immigrants have Houdini.
There's Booker T.
The African Americans have Booker T. The white people have Evelyn Nesbitt. They all have their kind of,
and they have Admiral Perry
and Admiral Perry, yeah. Right. But they all have their, and Emma Goldman has and the immigrants too.
Ford.
Right. So like the whites have Henry Ford,
Nesbitt.
Nesbitt and what's the other one? J.P. Morgan.
Right.
And then the immigrants have Emma Goldman and they have Houdini. So they all have like these real people that were actual, you know, moments in history that they kind of can use to punctuate and kind of ground their stories, which I really love and I think is really smart. One of my favorite moments that they actually kept from the original staging, or at least the idea of it, was when Tate is singing about America and like that bridge came down in this particular production.
That was very cool.
The bridge said prosperity on it in lights. And then as it got further and closer to the immigrants, the lights started burning out and the bridge kind of started to crush them. And then Houdini appears.
And also the lights burned out and what did it spell?
Oh, I actually didn't notice.
What did it say? When the bridge came down, what did it spell?
Prosperity.
So the lights went out, and when it hit them, it spelled property.
Oh, I did not notice that. That's amazing. I didn't notice that at all.
Well, when the lights were going out, I was like, oh no, it's a preview. I wonder if something's going wrong. when it got to them, they were
property. It said property. That's amazing. I didn't notice that. That's great. But then a Houdini appears and sings about how when you're something in life and failure seems imminent, think of Houdini, that fabulous immigrant, and he helps. Like uses a little magic.
What's funny is I didn't see that part.
Oh yeah, he uses a little magic to raise the bridge back up and free these immigrants from there. So the thought of Houdini, this the mental imagery of he was an immigrant. He came here poor. He made it. That's the American dream. I can do this too. So anytime they felt crushed by prosperity or becoming property, they could think of this icon that they can latch onto and say, if he could do it, I can do it. That's the American dream. I can get this.
Yeah.
And I love those moments of the show. I think they're so smart.
I think one thing that's interesting in 2019 is that I think, and this is probably no fault of the show. I think I told you last night that it feels dated to me.
It does. I agree.
Because its perspective on race feels a little dated to me.
Mm-hmm.
It has a little bit of the like, liberals' fantasy of like, if we all just communicate and get along. I don't think this is so. You took this a little different than me. I don't think this is a reflection of the way the real world is, that like our world now is so like terrible and cynical that no one can get along. I don't think if it was ever true, like this idea that if we just kind of get along, that like we can, the next generations will all get better. That's kind of what the message of the last moments of
absolutely,
this
musical are.
And I think that that is a little bit of a white liberal blind spot.
Mm-hmm.
That it's kind of like, no, there's a lot of crap to like that still has to be taken care of. And there's a lot of issues that don't get patched over just because people are like friendly with each other.
I think when the show opened, that kind of white liberal blind spot was much bigger.
Yes.
And I think there was a sense of, look at how far we've come. Things are great now.
Yeah.
Like there, you know, look at how things are so much better for people of color and people, immigrants and whatnot. And it's like living in 2019, it's like, oh no, they're not. Things aren't great. Things have never been great. We just didn't know about it, or we didn't pay enough attention to it. I mean, it's like we talk about with the news, like African-American men have been getting shot by the cops forever and they've been screaming for years.
But we know about it because of cell phones.
Right. They've been screaming for years and years and years about the horrible treatment by the police. And we didn't believe them. We flat out didn't believe them. And now that there's video proof of all of this, we're like, oh my God, you know, there's that blind spot is going away. And I think there's an enormous amount of guilt of like, this has been going on for so long, this systemic oppression and racism that we thought we had taken care of and we thought was gone.
Right.
And it wasn't. And, you know, when we were just thinking that people were just complaining that life wasn't good enough for them and it was, oh, it's because they're lazy or whatever. We didn't listen. And now that it's thrown in our faces and we see it on the nightly news every day, it's like, oh my God, how did we not know this?
Yeah. Well, that's why y'all need to calm down about trying to tell me Mary Poppins isn't racist. Because Hottentots is a racist term.
I was so on board with being against that article when it came out. I was so like, this is bullshit. Oh, come on, you know.
But also it just
because I didn't know what Hottentot meant. I didn't know what that term was.
But it also showed that no one read the source article. Because in the guy's source article, he's like, Hottentot, he like explained what it was.
Yeah, I didn't read the article.
Yeah, so everybody's so quick to be like, oh, people are overreacting. And then in the source article that the op-ed in the New York Times is about Mary Poppins, by the way, the original movie, where the guy's just like, there's a word called Hottentots, which is a racial slur for like a particular group of like, I think Dutch, South African, but Africans, that was well-known usage when P.L. Travers was writing the books. It's in one of the books. There's another part where people get soot on their face and they call them black heathens. And then in the movie Mary Poppins, she gets soot on her face. From a distance, Admiral Boom calls, says, we're being invaded by Hottentots. Mm-hmm. So it's very clearly using a racial slur that was in usage when P.L. Travers was writing books. Mm-hmm. And by the way, there's another thing where she like changed. Is it she, right? P.L. Travers?
Yes.
She changed the something into a macaw because it was originally like a racial stereotype and they changed it into a bird or whatever.
Oh,
that's in the original article too.
Oh, so anyway, I know that she did go back and revise.
P.L. Travers has some of the racist stuff in her writing.
Yeah.
So anyway, but that's what's funny is like that white liberal guilt needs to continue to be like, hey, if someone else says something now is racist, then like just whenever you get that impulse to be like, no, it's not. It's already like, just check that impulse slightly and go read up on the actual thing. And then maybe sometimes it's like, no, it's overreacting.
Yeah, people are overreacting. But you know, sometimes it's not.
Sometimes it's not.
And I don't think that Mary Poppins is a racist movie. I think that one moment is problematic.
Yeah.
And I think that I don't think it needs to be edited out. I don't think the movie needs to be censored. I don't think that people can't still enjoy the movie.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind. They could edit that out.
Sure. Because it's literally a two-line thing. Just cut it out. And
you can just go like, we're being invaded. Cut.
Done.
So the reason I bring it up with Ragtime is, and I am just thinking about this in our conversation, the lens of Ragtime is still pretty white because the perspective of the black, like third of the triangle, basically, or third of the show, is, I feel, less explored than, and I'm talking about Cole House and Sarah. I'm talking about the part where they're like, there's this one thing where they're like, we're not going to tell those crackers what we really know.
Right.
That whole side of it isn't explored very much in that show.
No.
That's about the only perspective you get into. Like, the people that have been really oppressed over the years, they would have a lot to say about, like, what's going to happen to Cole House's son in the future.
Right.
And I don't think that perspective is part of the ending of this show at all.
Right. Well, it's like the ending that's presented, I guess spoilers ahead if you don't know the show very well, but
well, it's just it's a very positive.
It's very positive. It's Tate and Mother end up together, so you have
that is a spoiler.
Well, I said spoilers ahead, but you have a presumably Christian woman marrying a Jewish man.
Oh, that's right. Yeah,
and then adopting Cole House, an African American child.
Yeah.
So, you know, you've got this kind of very mixed family that's supposed to, I think, represent like the dream of the melting pot and the dream of what America can be. And it's a very hopeful, very lovely, beautiful ending. But then in the car on the way home, you kind of addressed it. And it's something I never thought of, like, that kid's life is going to be awful.
Yeah.
That kid's life.
Well, because what year is it at that point?
It's like 1906.
Yeah.
Because there were like, 94 years to go.
Yeah, yeah. It's not going to be good.
Like,
even from his own family, it's not going to be good.
Right. I mean, they're not going to understand his perspective on things. They're not like, and they're always, he's always going to be looked at as an other.
Yeah.
And it's very, I mean, no matter how much they love him and how much they consider him their own, it's kind of like on This Is Us, the NBC show. There's the scene where they're at the pool and they talk about, you don't know how to comb your son's hair.
Yeah.
Things like that. Like there are going to be spots where they just don't know.
Yeah.
And so this kid's life is going to be hard and he's going to be kind of not really part of any community, because the white community certainly is not going to accept him, no matter how much the family does. The outside community is not going to. And then the African-American community is going to be like, well, you were raised by, you're not part of us either.
Yeah.
So it's like, this kid's life is going to be rough.
Yeah. So now, similarly, aside from the racial perspective, I think that the show has kind of a weird perspective about wealth, because Tate is not really a cautionary story about, like, about like what the American capitalist machine does to immigrants, how it grinds them down and spits them out. And, you know, Emma Goldman is who you should be listening to. And, you know, this fantasy about becoming one of the wealthy people, like what you're saying about, like, they all look at Houdini, like, he did it, I can do it. Mm-hmm. That's a, like, a pretty patently false prospect, and it's a thing that is used to exploit and oppress poor people still to this day in the country. It's kind of just like, actually he made it.
Yeah.
It's like
he was one of the lucky ones.
Well, yeah. But it's also just like, if you're smart and hardworking, you can do it, you can be rich. I mean, there's not a ton of like Tate being like really seeing through, like, I don't think he's on Emma Goldman's side by the end of the show. So that's interesting to me, because I thought in the first act they were very much making a point that she was trying to make, which is just like, you know, great, like, you, so, you know, you made a dollar or whatever like that, you're still going to be exploited by people like Henry Ford. You know, Henry Ford's up there going like, you know, work harder, like, make those things better, you know. It's interesting, because I feel like that criticism of capitalism doesn't really go anywhere. Does it? Am I missing something? It seems like Tate just gets rich.
I mean, he does. He definitely gets rich. I think, yeah, I mean, because you see him invent, like, the flip book, and then the next time you see him, he's...
When did he do that? When did he invent the flip book? I saw when the cop was like, give me that.
He right before Gliding, his song, he said, look what I made you. It's a little book of silhouettes. When you turn the pages, they move. See how nice.
Okay.
Yeah. He explains it in one of his songs that he's invented this little book, because he's a silhouette artist.
Right.
So he realizes that if you flip the book and make several, like, slightly different silhouettes, you get movement.
Right.
So he
basically invents cinema.
Right. Well, no, he does. Cause he says in Buffalo Nickel Photoplay Inc, his song, he says, I invent a small projector and now they're calling me director. So it really is stating that, like, Tata invented film.
Yeah.
Like, he invented movies. Yeah,
like, after they invented it in France already, but like, I almost would want to watch it again to see what happens to that anti-capitalist, like, thought.
I mean, he still says, like, even at one point he says, I'm no baron, you know, I'm a poor immigrant, I'm a Jew, I'm someone who came here with nothing, but I worked hard, basically, he said, you know, my daughter is my boss.
Yeah, I know.
That's basically stating, like, you know, everything I did was to drive every smell of every tenement out of her mind and just buy her clean air and freshness and whatnot. So,
but also, that's kind of bullshit. In our country, that's kind of like the idea that you just have to work hard and you can be like Henry Ford.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's an idealized version of the American dream. That's very much the premise of the show, is just America is this promise and this dream that you can, if you work hard enough, you can achieve it. And I believe that people still come to this country to catch the American dream, because they believe it still exists. And, you know, whether it ever did or not,
yeah,
there's, you know, there aren't those class systems so much. I mean, they're here, but, like, there are people who get out of, you know, who can escape poverty and make something of themselves and whatnot.
But the idea, the holding that ideal up is also what, like, CEOs use to oppress people. It's what, like, marketing and advertising use to exploit and extract dollars from people. It's what, you know, governments use to, like, essentially tax poor people by, like, putting lotteries on them, like, giving them this fantasy of being, you know, basically, like,
this will change your whole life,
and spending money that like, statistically will just go down the drain. By the way, I've never matched more than two numbers in the lotto.
That's the cautionary tale of this podcast.
Well, no, I guess what I'm saying is that, like, this show is bringing up the promise of the American dream, examining it, and then sort of being like, but
it's still there.
It's still there. Like, so that I would say is what I would compare and contrast this with Assassins, which Assassins is a very brutal look at even just the Constitution.
Oh yeah. I mean, know? Assassin is absolutely the other side of the coin.
Assassins comes to a very different conclusion about the American dream.
Yeah. That it's bullshit.
Yeah.
And that it's a lie. And that, yeah, I think there are places for both of these shows. I think it's just,
I guess I think like, this is not a show really examining that dream. It's sort of the thing where like, it's almost like a movie, a romance, where in the first half of the movie, they kind of questions the idea of like romance, and then they get married at the end.
Yeah.
It's kind of how it feels.
That being said, we should talk about the production. What did you think of the show itself? Like the actual production of it? Obviously, you talked about the sound mix being off, but like,
I thought it was good. I thought it was good. I thought the cast was good overall.
Yeah, the guy who played Houdini was original cast Book of Mormon, right?
Book of Mormon. He's a friend of a friend, John Accardo, one of our listeners.
Hey, John.
Ben Trader, who does Magic Bar over in Encino, played Houdini. He was good.
He's very good.
He's got an insane singing voice. I bet he can sit in the parking lot behind Pasadena Playhouse, and you can still hear him cutting through the mix.
he's got a very bell-like voice that cuts through.
Yeah, very strong. And I thought the ensemble was good. I thought
there just weren't enough of them.
I thought that it was good. It's interesting. It's the kind of show where I think more about the book, the material of it,
sure,
more than
the actual production.
So that's probably a compliment to the production, in that it sort of gets out of, like, I wasn't thinking like, oh, I wish the scene was played or sung better. Uh-huh. I was just sort of thinking about what it was about.
Yeah. I mean, we also, it was a second preview.
It was a preview,
so there were some
very funny moments.
There were some very...
Which I'm sure they'll fix. You won't see these issues.
Yeah, there were some technical issues.
Early projection at one moment. That's not that big a deal.
Well, it was a big deal simply because of when it happened.
Oh, it was during...
Cole House is literally singing to the coffin of Sarah, like, the say goodbye to music. And like, newspapers started flashing behind him for a second, which was very distracting.
Well, I thought for a second it was going to be like front page. I thought there were going to be headlines relevant to what he was singing about.
Yeah, and it was for the next scene.
Let me tell my you have the funniest one.
Go ahead.
But the one that I enjoyed was at the end of, is it called Our Children?
Mm-hmm.
Where they're like, our children, mm-hmm, our children. And then there's a clarinet solo started. So it was like, our children. And then the clarinet was like,
yeah.
I don't know who that clarinet player was. I'm sure that they felt just worse than anybody in the room.
But it was very funny.
There was not much music going on, and there was just one clarinet, and it was just like, so I feel for that clarinet player, but it was genuinely
hilarious.
Very funny.
Yeah.
Like, and all four of us were just like, no,
someone's getting fired. Yeah.
Someone's getting a big note. But that's almost the kind of mistake where it's like, you probably didn't need to give a note.
The person was like,
you know,
oh,
what happened.
I know exactly what happened, and it will never happen again.
But the funniest thing you saw.
Oh my God. It made me laugh so hard during the Emma night that Goldman spoke at Union Square. You know, there's the whole verse where she sings directly kind of to mother's younger brother, the whole, you there, what brings you to here? And they sing about, poor young rich boy masturbates for a vaudeville tart. So they all had, cause the ensemble was all on stage with their strike signs, cause they were supposed to be at a union rally. So they're all the signs on one side said strike, but when they flipped them, they were, you know, kind of calling out mother's younger brother. So they said like masturbator or pervert or all these different words on it. And at one point they were all back into the scene, the reality of the scene where they were at the strike. And there was one gentleman who was very emphatically waving a sign that said masturbator.
Just hearing Emma Goldman's like, strike.
Yeah. So they're like, strike, strike. And he very clearly noticed, because he was like, strike, strike, oh God. And like, I saw his face react, and then he flipped the sign as quickly as he could. But it was hilarious. Yeah. And
I didn't see it.
You were the only one of us who didn't.
Yeah, the other threes all started laughing.
We were all giggling, and he's like, what? What's up?
Yeah. Were you trying to tell me, is Daddy's Son one of your favorite songs? What are your favorite songs from this show?
I love Back to Before. I love Our Children. I love the title song. I love Daddy's Son. I love Wheels of a Dream. I love Make Them Hear You. Mm-hmm. I love Yeah. I mean, I love a lot of this
Crime
score.
Of the Century, you like?
I like Crime of the Century. It's fun.
Yeah.
I like What a Game. I think it's fun. The baseball song.
I'll say the I enjoyed What a Game, like their version of it. I thought it was good.
Yeah. There was one other moment that we think was a technical.
I need to ask about this.
Because there's a piano that tracked on and off several times. That
Kohlhaas goes to mother's and father's home.
Yeah, he's going to visit Sarah.
And she's like, play us something. And so now this is what I will say. The stool for the piano was on stage.
Yeah, he sat down. So the piano was supposed to come out, I think.
No, but he picked it. It was upside down. Mm-hmm. He picked it up and put it down and sat on it.
Oh.
Whereas before, that stool had been on the piano the whole time.
Huh.
So maybe that was a sign of like, hey, the piano's not working.
Maybe. But like the piano had come on and off a couple of times. Yes. So it made no sense for there not to be a piano at this point. But so he sits down and he's like, this is called ragtime. And he takes off his hat and puts it where the edge of the top of the piano would be and then drops it to the floor.
Yeah.
And then proceeds to mime playing piano. And he mimed the entire piece of new music, just basically miming piano with no piano there. It was so very strange.
It was a very odd metaphorical moment because the piano had been established as like the piano is here.
It's a real thing.
But then he put the hat on and it made me laugh out loud because I was like, that's kind of funny. It was a meta real moment where he put the hat on the piano and it fell. So it seemed to be highlighting that there wasn't a piano there.
Yeah. I kind of wonder if that was a little actor like.
Well, Jesus. So the thing is that I didn't, that to me emphasized that it was not a mistake. Because it was like that's highlighting the fact that the piano's not.
Yeah, there. He could have very clearly kept the hat on. So if it was a directorial choice, it was a weird one, and I don't understand what the point of it
because
was.
Because afterwards, I thought it was intentional. The other three people thought it was
a mistake. Yeah.
But also, his miming of the piano in that was more precise than during any other point in the show.
Yeah, that was so weird.
That made
too.
Me think the piano isn't here. He's learned how to mime the piano of, is it like Haunted or whatever it is? What's the name of that song?
New Music.
Oh, he kept saying the word haunting. Or
yeah, haunting me and somehow taunting me.
So that but made me think that was on purpose maybe to highlight those. Because he, I don't know what you call it, finger synced to the piano through the very precisely. And there was a scene before when they were like, Kohlhaas Walker is great at playing piano. And he was not in sync with
when
the piano.
When he first plays like Sarah's theme, I was watching it going like, he's really not
right. So for that one song, he learned it really well.
Yeah. But anyway, because it didn't, what wouldn't make sense is like, that's not Kohlhaas' song. He's basically accompanying Father. Father sings that song.
Oh, right.
So there, why would that doesn't that's make true. A whole lot of sense.
Yeah.
So it was a weird moment.
So a shout out to Ryan Dietz, my friend from New York Improv, who I still haven't. We haven't gone down to see him in Frozen in Anaheim at Disneyland, but he was in this. He played Henry Ford. He played a very variety good. Of roles. Very good. I need to ask Ryan what happened with that.
Yeah.
Also, I want to give a shout out.
That masturbator moment, though. God, if
yeah,
if
I gotta ask him about that.
If that ensemble member did not mention that backstage to anybody, you need to talk about it because it's real damn funny.
Also, not relevant to anything. A shout out to Meredith Hackman, who recently messaged me and was like, "Oh, I thought I'd been chatting when we talked about The Favorite."
That's right.
She thought I was chatting around when talking about The Favorite, and I actually wasn't. But now we are, and Meredith, you should go see Ragtime.
We love you.
Tell us what you think about it. I will say there should have been more Asians in this show.
There were none.
There should have been more than zero.
Talk about a big blind spot as far as history goes.
Yeah, this is set in
1904.
In Yonkers or New York City?
It's New Rochelle in New York.
Oh, yeah, it's not Yonkers. I was like, this is the same city as Hello Dolly.
Yeah, you leaned over and I was like, no, that's Yonkers.
And it's New Rochelle. But does some of it take place in New York City?
Yeah.
Okay. Because Emma Goldman's in Union Square.
In Union Square, yeah. Okay, all the tenement stuff.
So I'm quite sure there's a lot of Chinese people in the picture at that point in some capacity, in some like, you know, sweatshop or garment district.
So. Sure.
Maybe that's what I write is the one fourth that was cut out from Ragtime.
There you
that's
go.
The Chinese perspective.
I like it.
I will say that if you have ever seen Lord of the Rings, This did remind me of Lord of the Rings at one point, because it's basically, there's a part in Lord of the Rings that's like the battle of the three races or whatever. That's like humans, orcs, and something else. And it's this big, gigantic battle of like these three worlds colliding.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we watched the Broadway, a clip of the Broadway staging, I was like, oh, it reminds me of Lord of the Rings.
The opening number.
Because they all like come and like confront each other in one spot.
Uh-huh.
If you're in Los Angeles, I believe this runs until March
13th, I think, somewhere in there.
Let me get the exact dates, but you should definitely go see it if you're in the Los Angeles area.
Yeah, it's a very strong production. I think it will get better once they work out some of the technical flubs there.
March 3rd.
And also, the theater itself is beautiful. I'd never been to the Pasadena Playhouse before. It's a lovely facility.
And we will definitely go again.
Yeah, absolutely. They seem to be doing very good work, and I'm excited to see what else they do.
Yeah.
But yeah, if you're in the area, if you're in LA, by all means check it out. It's a very strong production of a show that I love. And while this has made me rethink the actual text and show itself, it's a strong production, and I still love the score.
Yeah. Seems like it's occasionally available on Gold Star if you want to see it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. Well, the first review of it on Gold Star is, the MAGA group should see this to try to understand what their hatred leads to.
Oh, my.
And it's a little bit like, that's sort of that liberal blind spot that I'm talking about. Because I'm not sure that this would like really change the minds of like someone with a MAGA hat on.
Probably not.
Yeah, you should definitely go see. I'm almost tempted to go see it again when you're in Australia from an orchestra seat.
Yeah.
And see what that sound mix is like.
Yeah.
So
you should. Yeah,
maybe I will.
All right. It's not pick on Eric Day.
No, it's not. So
you only got three more days with me.
That's right. So Eric will be in Australia for the next episode.
Yep.
We'll figure out what we're going to do. You're going to go with a microphone.
I am.
You can interview your castmates about theater, and he's going to be seeing a bunch. I'm sure you're going to see a bunch of Adelaide Fringe shows.
Absolutely. I'm very excited.
We'll talk about highlights there.
Yay.
And I think that's all. In case you didn't know, our production of Voldemort and the Teenage Hogwarts music parody is going back to the Edinburgh Fringe this year.
Oh, this is the official announcement of
No, just the Edinburgh Fringe part. Oh, the Edinburgh Fringe part. Yeah, sure.
Yeah,
that's so, what I meant. We have other things that are potentially in the works, but we're still ironing out. But yeah, I mean, it's we can announce it because I've already signed a contract that obligates us to it.
You didn't tell me that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So I signed that like 2 weeks ago.
This is my husband, and he's not telling me things.
Yeah, well, I'm the producer. I don't tell all the talent. All the details.
Yeah, but I'm your husband. That doesn't make me part of the talent.
Tell that to P.T. Barnum.
Oh, God.
So Voldemort and the Teenage Hogwarts Music Parody, we're going back to the Edinburgh Fringe this year. We'll be there from August 1st through 26th.
Hooray.
Probably with a day off. Eric is going back.
Well, I don't know. I have to weigh it. I don't know if I have talked to the rest of the talent yet.
That's true. Well, so as many of the American cast as we can get is going to go back. And then we might cast with some new London folks or something. But we're definitely going back. It's going to be 5 p.m. every single day at the Edinburgh Fringe. Exact same venue, exact same time as last year.
Come check us out.
Yeah.
We were a big hit last year, and we're going to be a bigger hit this year.
Yeah. And if you're in Australia for the next month, go see Thrones of Musical Parody at the Adelaide Fringe. You can go see Eric.
It's at 9:30 p.m. every evening in Gluttony.
And you can see Eric portray a variety of Thrones characters, including some of your fan favorites.
Mm-hmm.
And if you happen to be in Australia and you see the show, please say hi to Eric afterwards.
Yes, please do. Like, if you see me around, or if you come to see Thrones, please wait after and let me know that you listen to the podcast.
Yeah.
I'd love to meet some people.
Say the open call secret password, which is?
I listen to open call sometimes.
That's one of the longer passwords you can make, but yeah, it'll work. So we'll see you next time.
Bye.
Bye.